Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the newest episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. You all know me. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two partners in crime. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Howdy.
Howdy. Coming to you a little bit later than usual because this weekend was particularly hectic, but we still have a fantastic episode in store for you. We will be talking about the Michael Bay passion project, Pain and Gain, starring Mark Wahlberg, Anthony Mackie, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, on top of a bevy of other actors and character actors who are constantly in Michael Bay films, it seems. And before we get into that, we'll be giving you our top three selections for movies coming out this summer, so you have that to look forward to. Then after both of those things are done, we will give you our recommendations for things coming out in the week ahead, as well as a random recommendation of something that we watched on our own. This is a reminder, you can always use the chapter selection arrows at the bottom of your podcast player to skip to a specific section, so if you are just trying to see if we liked Pain and Gain, don't want to listen to the spoilers just yet, you can always feel free to flip over those and then come back to them whenever you're ready. So, that should serve us pretty well for an intro, right? Got everything covered? No, I don't! Comment, rate us on iTunes, and yeah, I think that's it. That's it, right?
I think we're
That should be good.
All right, sweet. So now that we got all the business stuff over, let's get down to the fun. Today we will be giving you our selections for the top three movies, for me personally, in no particular order, that we are looking forward to this summer. Summer, by the way, just so everyone knows, the beginning of May to the last weekend of August. We are not including September. That may be a controversial decision. I don't know. If you have a problem with it, let us know. You can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com.
Yeah, but do we want to deal with people who are actually going to email over this?
I would be interested to hear some of the defenses for like actually making a big deal out of that. Like, who are these people who feel September is so necessary? I don't even know when Labor Day is, so I can't even go off that metric. Anyway, not important. Nick Newman, let's start off with you. We'll be going one movie each in a circle as we did every other time that we've done a list like this until we get to the last one for each and every one of us. Nick, first of all, are you going to be doing yours in any order or are you just kind of spitting them out?
I figured I would, you know, do it in just an order, but now that you...
Well, I wasn't sure if you were...
Because
mine are just kind of universally like, I'm looking forward to these. I don't know if I've placed them in any kind of...
I'll go in order, I guess.
Okay, well, while you're doing that, I'll figure this out real quick. All right, I'm ready. All right, so you begin, we'll go to Danny, and then I'll finish this up. So, Nick Newman, your first top choice for this summer's releases.
Yes, so number three on the list is going to be Only God Forgives, which is Nicholas Winding Refn's new film starring Ryan Gosling. It's their reunion from Drive, which was the... big smash hit success in September of 2011. And this follow-up looks markedly different, I think, from Drive, even though Refn has, I think, achieved a certain auteur status for his particular stylings. This does seem to be enough of a divergence. And as a big fan of Drive, that only excites me more to kind of see how they'll do this different tone and in this different setting. It appears to be a much darker film. And Drive is already a semi-dark movie, I would say. And, you know, it'll be premiering at Cannes in May, but we still really don't know much about it. We kind of have a basic plot synopsis, and there's been some footage, but a lot of it still seems like a big mystery to me. And I'm wondering sort of what the result will be when Gosling and Refn are allowed to make a movie on their own in Taiwan together. I feel like the results of that will be fascinating and disturbing.
Fascinating and disturbing. That is a perfect way to describe the man who will give us his next selection. Danny King.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what that's meant to imply. But I agree with Nick that film is up there for me. But for number three, I'll go with a pretty safe choice in Before Midnight, Richard Linklater's new film and in the series that co-stars Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. We've gotten one every 9 years, and here this one is right on schedule, apparently on par with the other two films. And I actually had a funny experience with this film last night because I saw a film in theaters, and I had heard that the Before Midnight trailer was playing at that theater. So I was very prepared, and when I saw the Sony Pictures Classics logo, I kind of plugged up my ears and made like a humming sound and closed my eyes. And I'm pretty grateful that the movie wasn't crowded, because if someone was sitting next to me, I don't know what they would have thought I was doing, because it probably looked a little strange. But yeah, so I'm trying to read as little as possible and not watch the trailer because I've heard it's spoilery, and quite anticipating the release. I'll also probably, you know, rewatch the first two beforehand, which should be equally rewarding.
You know, it's funny that you say you were doing that, because something that I've realized recently is that, like, the movie geek thing, like the comic nerd type of thing to do previously, had been to, like, avoid spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been, like, this paradigm shift where, like, everyone wants to know everything about the movie before they go in. Like, people want to know what the stinger at the end of Iron Man 3 is.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's, like, us. It's the indie people who are like, I don't want to know anything. Don't even tell me what the character names are.
Yeah. Well, this one I've heard specifically that the trailer gives something away.
Literally, I'm not exaggerating, the thumbnail of the trailer is a spoiler.
Damn. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so, like, this is like an extreme case. I mean, normally I'll sit through trailers and I'll watch them, but this was like an exception.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people, and it's crazy. I have not seen the other Before films, which I know marks me out as something of an oddity in our circles. I will, however, be rectifying that before that film is released. So hopefully I'll be able to get in on that one. That was actually going to make my top list until I realized that my anticipation was based on nothing. Nothing at all, except the good things I've heard about it from other people who've seen the other movies. And that's really not enough to really form a strong opinion.
Yeah,
so, thank you. Here are my top three. I'm going to be doing them in order. I know everything I said before. It was all a lie. So my number three most anticipated film of the summer is actually Man of Steel.
Ooh.
Yeah. I wasn't really interested in this until the last trailer came out. And for some reason, I liked what I saw. You know? I don't know what it is about it. I got a good feeling about this film. And it's got a little bit of the Nolan fingerprints on it, which is always a good thing. I know that Zack Snyder can make an interesting film, and we'll find out if he can finally make a good one. And, yeah, I don't know. Michael Shannon, guys, like, you can't deny that man. So hopefully it'll be good. And
yeah.
One of us has to represent the big summer spectacle blockbuster, right?
Yeah, and it's a pretty impressive trailer. It kind of reminds me of the Lincoln trailer, just in terms of, like, how much emotional impact it's trying to, like, get. Like, it's really trying to, like, cram in, like, a huge swells of emotion in the trailer. I mean, like, when you see that trailer in a theater, it's like this is the movie of the decade. Like, come pay for it four times. And
it does have that kind of grandiosity to it. All right. Well, that's it for me for that one. So, Nick, you're up next. What's your number two?
Two is going to be Before Midnight, the Richard Linklater film starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy.
Oh,
you know,
about?
I could tell you, actually, because know what it's about, but I guess we'd be sort of a spoiler. They walk around and they talk to each other. Spoiler.
That sounds pretty gay.
Yeah. It's really gay.
No spoilers.
So number one is, I should probably pick this up. I had actually never seen the two movies until this past January. The day after Before Midnight had premiered, and people were going, it was screened for Al Pacino, obviously. And I had seen the reaction, and I'd heard about the movies for a long time, but I'm not a huge Richard Linklater fan, so I didn't really know people like them. I'd heard of them, but I didn't know people really liked them until about a year ago. So anyway, I had not seen them, and then I watched them, and I was really big fan. I feel a little guilty being excited for it, honestly, because I feel like sort of a jerk. You know, oh, I can't wait to see a sequel to the movie I watched 4 months ago, whereas other people have been waiting for 9 years. And the second movie ends on sort of a cliffhanger, too, so... there were screenings that I could have attended, but I didn't. And I thought to myself, I could, you know, I waited long enough. I could probably wait a couple more weeks. But that doesn't mean I'm not excited. I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm anticipating it more than, basically any other summer movie except for one. So, I think it'll. The thing is, there's been a lot of hype around it. And friend of mine, David Ehrlich, great guy. He helps run the site film.com, has called it one of the greatest films ever made. And obviously that's sort of setting a bar.
that's perfectly reasonable.
And he's a very, very smart guy. I mean, he has a very deep, wide knowledge of film and film history. So for him to be saying that is... means a lot.
I haven't heard any. This is one of those films where you'd expect that there'd be dissenters, but I've heard almost nothing but universal, like adulation and praise.
It'll be interesting to see the first negative reviews come in and sort of how they're going to. I am curious because I've read a number of positive reviews of the movie, and that's sort of why I know what happens in it. Not that I really care, but. The negative reviews, because I know what the positive ones have to say, I'm curious to see what the naysayers will come down on the film for. But, you know, we'll see soon enough.
Indeed we shall. And we will also see what Danny's number two is.
Oh, quite, yes.
I'm just, like, on a roll with these segues today.
Very, very well done.
Thank you.
So number two for me is Frances Ha, the new film from Noah Baumbach. And if memory serves, I feel like Nick is a bit of a Noah Baumbach skeptic.
Hey, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Is there a specific film of his that makes you a skeptic or just everything?
The only thing that doesn't make me a skeptic actually is The Squid and the Whale, which I love. I think that's pretty much a perfect movie. But his other work I find very off-putting and alienating and... Those are sort of the same thing, but anyway, I find them very, very unpleasant and almost kind of intentionally so. His work, a lot of it feels like posturing to me, honestly. And I think because The Squid and the Whale is such a kind of a sort of the subject it deals with, divorce is a much more kind of emotionally naked thing, whereas his other films, which kind of deal with like romantic relationships and all that, not to get off on too much of a tangent, it strikes me as sort of false and, again, posturing. Like, it's very much trying to get a reaction.
Yeah.
I am looking forward to Frances Ha very much. It's a great trailer.
I was going to say, like, that. I kind of agree with what you're saying about his most recent films, but this one looks warmer. Just like the idea of it, like an 80-minute black and white film that he made and co-wrote with Greta Gerwig. It just has this like appealing feel to it. I like his previous work and I like the direction that he's been going in. And I'm looking forward to this, even though it seems like it's going to be something different. And I remember last year on the fall festival circuit, just kind of getting like a surprise rush when this started showing up out of nowhere. Like, I don't think anyone knew he was making this. At least I didn't, and I hadn't heard anything. So I kind of just like that idea of a filmmaker like that, just kind of showing up with a movie and saying, you know, watch it and like it. I tried really hard to make a good movie. Please enjoy it.
Yeah. I'm not sure how I feel about this film. I'm not a fan of the trailer. Not at all.
Really?
Oh, wow. No, I don't know, man. It just doesn't do it for me. No. And I don't know why.
Do you not like Modern Love?
Yeah, no, I'm really not a fan of any kind of affection. So, I mean,
I literally mean the song.
Yeah, this... Thanks.
Okay.
That's literally what I meant.
I thought, never mind.
I mean, I guess Water and Love too as a concept, but more specific.
No, I don't know. It's just something about like the whole dancing thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm just still like have a bad taste in my mouth from Damsels in Distress.
That definitely had dancing.
It did have dancing. It also had Greta Gerwig. So I'm just like, but I did kind of enjoy Greenberg.
But Greta Gerwig is great. I mean, she is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's...
All right. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, let's move on. Let's get out of here. My next film is The Great Gatsby.
Ooh.
By Baz Luhrmann.
Ah.
Indeed. That is actually, Danny, the perfect response to have to this, since that trailer is just like filled with fireworks and visuals that emulate fireworks. This could be a fucking disaster. I'm not denying that. And I think that the tightrope it's walking, the precipice that it hangs over, being a big budget, spectacle blown 3D for some strange reason movie that's about one of based on one of the best, most understated and thoughtful books that I've ever read. I don't know. It seems weird. But just like taking PCP and fighting the cops, you know, it could end up being a good time. So, who knows?
it's a really
wow. Yeah.
Is anyone else at all interested in The Great Gatsby?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'll be there. It's a good trailer.
Which trailer? The one with that rendition of
Yeah, I remember we talked about that, that cover.
I can't remember. Did Nick have an attempt at trying to sing that?
No.
I know every once in a while you try to sing some trailer music.
I didn't try to sing that.
Okay.
Maybe I could, like, but no.
He's still perfecting his Javier Bardem impression.
I could sing it as Javier Bardem.
I'm waiting.
All right.
Were you pausing, like waiting for me to start singing it or something? No.
Damn it.
Absolutely.
Right. Anyway. I don't know. Leonardo DiCaprio, Tobey Maguire, who was apparently so good. Was that him that was so good in Life of Pi they had to cut him out?
Tobey Maguire?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They cut him out, yeah.
Yeah.
For Rafe Spall.
He was the Rafe Spall character. Yeah. Hilarious. Anyway. Yeah, and also I love the actress who's playing Daisy, whose name I can't remember right now.
Mulligan,
Carey Mulligan. Yeah, I love Carey Mulligan. I'd watch her paint a house. That's not a proper analogy at all.
Oddly, that does sound like something I would want to watch, though.
I'm sure she will do that in a movie quite soon, and it'll be a metaphor. But let's move on. Nick, why don't you give us your number one anticipated film for the summer?
Sure. This comes for us in the United States. This comes right at the very end of the summer, actually, on August 23rd. It's Edgar Wright's *The World's End*, which is sort of the, I guess, spiritual conclusion to what is called his Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy, which had started with *Shaun of the Dead* in 2004. It had continued with *Hot Fuzz* in 2007. And this movie has been talked about since Hot Fuzz. I remember reading about it, I guess that was like 6 years ago now. And he went off and he did Scott Pilgrim, which took some time, and now he's coming back to this and, reuniting with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. And it also features Patty Considine and Rosamund Pike and Martin Freeman and Eddie Marsan. Rafe Spall's in it, too. That's weird.
Oh, nice.
Everybody playing needs some Rafe Spall.
Playing the same character as Life of Pi.
Oh, really? Is this like a Avengers-style kind of crossover?
Yeah, it's really weird. Right, anyway.
Is Patty Considine going to be the journalist from the Bourne Ultimatum?
Yeah, that's a good reference. I think that, Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, which, like this, he co-wrote with Simon Pegg, I think they're both perfect films, and I think that they are just sort of... They speak to my comedic sensibilities very strongly, but not only that, I think Edgar Wright is probably this is going to sound very strong. I think he's as attuned to the visual language of comedy as pretty much almost any filmmaker who has ever lived. I know that sounds like a lot, but I really do mean it. I think that he understands sort of how to convey comedy through images in a really profound, deep way. And, I mean, yeah, for this to be coming out is sort of like a dream come true. I remember when it was announced a year ago, I like lost my head. I couldn't believe that it was actually happening. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a while coming, and hopefully it'll be worth the wait. We shall see.
Good for you.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I hated Scott Pilgrim. So I'm been soured on a lot of stuff. But,
Well, first of all, I'm sorry that you're wrong. But secondly, what about you don't like? I mean, come on, you have to like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, right?
Hot Fuzz. Shaun of the Dead was a thing that I watched once, and then not any desire to return to.
You have to watch it again because Shaun of the Dead is perfect. It is a perfect film. It is perfectly written. And composed and edited and acted and scored. I mean, it's a once in a lifetime kind of movie, I believe.
Yes, as in you see it once and never have to see it again. I don't know, man. Why do you like that film so much?
Because I think that it has a very innate understanding of what makes comedy function as a tool. And it also has a very keen sense of the way that you can balance it with horror and the way one can the way they can refract off of one another and sort of come to resemble each other, and that's also reflected in the movie's sense of structure, sort of the mirrored nature of it, and the way that lines of dialogue come to bounce off each other later in the film in ways that are so good that I just sort of, I'm amazed that this hasn't been aped more often, or maybe it has and I didn't realize it because it just didn't work as well. I think Shaun of the Dead is a perfect movie. And I'd probably say the same for Hot Fuzz too, which is strong in very similar ways, only that is a really amazing genre subversion that sort of uses its first half to give way to a second half that kind of makes this oscillation into a completely different territory, but something that is completely organic to what had preceded it. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not really sure. Genre-wise, I guess The World's End is sci-fi. It seems like
something like that. Yeah.
But honestly,
I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to The World's End because it does have. I don't know. I'm also getting really tired of Simon Pegg. Is that okay to say?
I mean, he doesn't really make many good films. I feel like he only makes good films with Edgar Wright and Shyamalan.
Yeah. So my problem, I still got Simon Pegg in Paul. Was that the one?
Yeah.
Or the alien.
Yeah.
And
great.
Then there's all the other films he's made that are awful.
He's been in good. I feel like when he works with good filmmakers, he can be good. He was
like Brad Bird in Ghost Protocol.
Brad Bird, and I really enjoyed him and Nick Frost in Tintin, and Star Trek. I thought he was very good, even if his appearance is brief.
Yeah.
So
I like. Patrick,
I mean, Brian, he's got to pay the bills, you know.
I know. All right. Anyway, I do like Paddy Considine. He's in one of my favorite movies that no one else has ever seen. Dead Man's Shoes. Anyway, let's move on, because I'm still blown away by all the love that was just heaped upon some fairly mediocre films.
I
don't know, but like I can understand a little bit of the love for Shaun of the Dead because it was like a new, fresh thing. But like the characters were just like bizarrely unlikable at all times and never
I don't think that's true at all.
Well, I think it is.
I mean,
you can't convince me.
To the Wonder. I mean, that's
no. I mean, those guys were like hang out, have a beer, fall down, awesome.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about good screenplays, let's look at To the Wonder, please.
All right.
It's about to get personal.
Yeah, let's save this for Pain and Gain.
I'm actually really excited to talk about Pain and Gain. Anyway,
yeah, I don't know what that was supposed to mean.
Danny, why don't you give us your last one?
All right, so my number one, which I'm very excited about, naturally, is the Bling Ring.
Oh, that's a good choice. I didn't even think about that.
Sofia Coppola. This film will be playing at Cannes, out of competition, which is interesting because it will clearly be the masterpiece of the festival. I mean, no question. But yeah, I'm basically just a big fan of Sofia Coppola in general. And I know she kind of gets some flack for,
because she's rich.
Yeah. But right? Like, you're saying that ironically, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah.
I feel like she gets flack for kind of the same reason that Lena Dunham gets flack. From people who don't have, like, cogent arguments.
Yeah, but Sofia Coppola has also made, like, 4 excellent feature films.
It's funny how people like Sofia Coppola and Lena Dunham get a lot of flack, but someone like, you know, Duncan Jones doesn't. And I feel like that sort of speaks to, I don't know, maybe some misogyny.
Well, what I mean, people give Brett Ratner untold amount of shit. So.
You're missing the point. What I'm saying. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yes. So that's a very good point. One thing worth mentioning on the Bling Ring is that I believe it's the last credited film for cinematographer Harris Savitas, who died in October. Who is just a great cinematographer from, you know, Zodiac, countless great films. And so that aura will kind of give this something special. Apparently there's also a second credited cinematographer who worked on Meek's Cut Off, and he's also working on Kelly Reichardt's next film. So that seems pretty impressive to me. And, you know, it will inevitably be included in the year's most consistent theme of the American dream, I would imagine, which I'm sure we'll be talking about later in this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes, Bling Ring. To quote Nick Newman, I would pay $200 to see it right now.
Yes.
Good reference. Yeah, no, I gotta agree. That actually is a pretty damn good choice. I didn't see that on the site that I used to help select mine, so that's a letdown. But it's good because it gives us a little bit more variety. My number one film from the Sundance Film Festival, Ain't Them Bodies Saints.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heard good things. I like everyone who's in it, and I've avoided learning a lot more, except that the rough outline of the story appeals to me on an innate level, so don't have a lot of good reasons, good quantifiable reasons, but I got a lot of anticipation, and that's what the list is about.
I'll give you a good reason. The director of that film edited Upstream Color.
Yeah, I do know that.
Yeah, and he also edited Sun Don't Shine.
He also looks like
he looks weird.
Bronson.
Yeah,
he looks exactly like Tom Hardy as Bronson.
Oh my god, yeah. I want to see it even more now. Even though I don't get to see him, but
yeah, I don't know why he looks that way.
But it clearly works for Ain't Them Bodies Saints. Like,
yeah, but I'm not going to see the movie. It's so weird.
Good times. That's it. That's it. I'm over. It's done. Yeah. I wish I could replace something with the Bling Ring, but it's a little too late for that. So we'll just have to deal with the choices we've made. And that'll bring us to the end. So let us know if you have any movies that you'd like to single out. You can always look and you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com, or you can harass us on Twitter. But you have to stay to the end of the episode to hear our Twitter handles. So incentive to continue listening.
What summer movies are we not looking forward to?
I'm not looking forward to Iron Man.
Yeah. The reaction so far has been decent.
Yeah, the word's been a little encouraging.
Then again, it was for the Avengers, too.
That's my concern, but I do I do like Shane Black.
Yeah. Star Trek Into Darkness just looks kind of like a bull.
Yeah,
I still don't know what that movie's about. Like, I've seen so many trailers, and they legitimately just seem like a fan cut of like, these are my top five scenes from Star Trek Into Darkness, devoid of context.
It's weird because Benedict Cumberbatch plays Khan in the film.
Is that confirmed now?
Yeah, it's been confirmed, but they're like hiding it, and I don't understand why, because I read basically a full plot synopsis of the film, and it doesn't sound as if that's actually germane to the plot. Like, he could literally just be
a guy.
British man, angry British man. But I find that interesting. It's sort of like a sign that they're not confident in how fans will receive it. And I spoke to someone, they will go unnamed, but I spoke to someone who saw it and they hated it. So
I'm not
this was someone who likes Star Trek too, but they said that it was
it just looks like a mess. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of shit happening. It's so visually busy, like I can't tell what's going on. And like there's a problem, and then they go somewhere, and then there's more of a problem, and then Benedict Cumberbatch is, you know, he's Benedict Cumberbatch. That's just how he is.
But I mean, like, it is probably going to tackle some dark themes. You know?
I mean, it is Into Darkness.
Yeah. So, and like, I've never seen that before. It could be.
Yeah.
Be amazing.
Also, just want to say, Monsters University. Every time I see a preview for it, makes me so sad because it looks so bad. And I was, you know, I mean, I love Monsters Inc. when I was younger, so to kind of, Hangover Part 3, no. Even though the preview is kind of funny, no, please. The Wolverine, no.
World War Z, anyone?
Probably not. Kick-Ass 2, you've
got to
be kidding. Kick-Ass 2 looks like an MTV Movie Awards skit.
Oh, God, honestly. It does. It's so I'm so upset because I liked Kick-Ass.
Yeah, I liked it when it came out, but I've soured on it since. And just the idea is the first movie didn't really do that well. It's like you don't need a sequel to it.
No.
3 years later, Afterworth from M. Night.
I can't wait to watch and talk about it, but I'm not anticipating it.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I know some people are excited for Fast and Furious 6. Those movies don't really do anything for me, so I'm kind of on the outside of that.
Yeah. I'm kind of looking forward to the Fast 6.
I mean, I know people enjoy them, and I sort of get it, but there's something about the sort of the reaction to it which kind of strikes me as suspicious among some people. I can't really go into it because it would sort of sound like I'm just like a jerk, or more so. But the way some people treat the series, I feel like they're kind of giving it too much credit. So anyway, two more positives. The Grandmaster from Wong Kar-wai, I'm looking forward to, even if recent word has not been very good.
Mm-hmm.
It is still Wong, so I'm still anticipating it. And Blue Jasmine from Woody Allen, too. Always willing to see what he's doing next. So
I'm not looking forward to The Internship.
Yeah.
Is anyone?
Doesn't the movie look like it should have come out in 2005?
Yeah.
It feels like it was made at the same time that The Incredible Burt Wonderstone was made, and they were both held way too long.
They were shot on the same set.
Exactly.
Studio sent those particular comedy actors to the same set just to kind of get them off their hands.
Precisely. All right, that should do us. I think we're good. So let's move on. Let's talk about the newest film by Michael Bay. Came out this weekend, made a mint, and was number one at the box office. It is Pain and Gain, the story of a bunch of thieving, heisting bodybuilders played by Mark Wahlberg, Anthony Mackie, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Also co-starring Tony Shalhoub, Ed Harris, Rob Corddry, and Rebel Wilson.
Hot! I'm big!
No!
No!
My name is Daniel Lugo, and I believe in fitness. All this began because it was time to push myself harder.
Oh, there you go, yes!
Otherwise, I was looking at another 40 years of wearing sweatpants to work.
Mr. Doble, are you currently using steroids?
I think they messed me up.
Don't worry, that's what we specialize in here. Penis magic.
I'm a self-made man. I made a lot of money.
Maybe yourself ought to spend some of it on a salad.
You know who invented salad? Poor people. I'm hot.
I was so happy when this movie opened, and it's exactly like the opening of the trailer.
Right.
Because I've watched the trailer so many times, it always makes me smile. So to see it open like this was...
It literally was, just like the first minute of the movie was the trailer.
Oh, man, it was just so good.
Masterful. So yeah, this is the story of a group of bodybuilders who work at a gym in Miami who get caught up in a kidnapping scheme that they believe will help them to gain control of their lives. This is a movie by provocateur Michael Bay. A provocateur. I actually like that, yeah. What was I going to say? Who did we have on here who came up with, or was talking about, like...
You're thinking of Ethan?
Was it the gross auteur or something?
Vulgar auteur.
Vulgar auteur. Yeah.
The gross auteur.
You know,
I feel like gross auteur would be like Rainer Werner Fassbinder, who was this fat guy with a big beard. He didn't really look like he bathed much. Like, that would be... Well, actually, I actually mentioned Fassbinder in my review of this movie, so that's appropriate.
Yeah,
I guess.
I saw that. That was interesting.
Yeah. No, vulgar and gross are kind of... different in this case.
Yes, they are. But anyway, let's talk about how we feel about this movie. Nick, why don't you kick us off?
I'm a big fan of Pain and Gain, which is not necessarily a surprise for this movie, because I've been looking forward to it. From the first trailer, which is just so funny and so amusing, I've been thinking that this would be an interesting sea change for Mr. Michael Bay, who I've not really been a big fan of in the past. I like a few films of his, but you know, he's been doing the Transformers series, which I enjoy the first one generally. The second one I think is just heinous, and the third I never even saw. So this is actually the first Michael Bay movie I've seen in the theater in almost 4 years.
Your assertions about the Transformers films sync up directly with my own. So
have you not seen the third?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's good. This will help us to get over the schism created by our varying feelings on Edgar Wright.
Yes. So going into this, you know, I saw it with Danny, and before we were kind of talking about our expectations for it. And what's interesting is that the movie lives up to them, I think, fully, but not in ways that I was necessarily expecting. I think the movie... is actually a very... It's really fascinating that Michael Bay would make this, because it is sort of a... kind of a critical look at the Michael Bay... Not necessarily style, but sort of what that style embraces and what that style, if not necessarily condones, at least permits and enables. And it does feel like... I find it interesting that this movie got a bad rating on CinemaScore, because I think that it probably... offended the audience who this movie was marketing toward, in a way, sort of the meathead crowd, jocks. When in fact, this is portraying them as meatheads and very bad people. But the movie toes this very interesting line where it's able to kind of play with that and be critical, but also be a lot of fun too, and very funny and energetic. You know, it's something like 2 hours and 10 minutes, but I think it sort of flies by. It's very well paced. It was written by Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who had written Captain America, a movie that I was not a huge fan of. But I do think that when Bay is working with more legitimate screenwriters and not Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci, who are not legitimate screenwriters, they had scripted the Transformers films in The Island, in case listeners did not know. Or no, yeah, The Island, that's what it was.
Really? Because I kind of enjoyed The Island, but I hated it.
Oh, okay.
He's done worse films.
Yes.
That's not saying a lot.
Okay, so I think that when he's able to, when he has to work with screenwriters who aren't going to kowtow to his demands, and in some way they have to rein him in, he can really do good things, because I think that Bay has, I mean, he absolutely has a sense of visual style. I think that what he's done since Bad Boys really has kind of redefined the summer blockbuster and its visual aesthetic. And to see that applied here in this smaller story and something that kind of doesn't really require actually that much in the way of action sequences is sort of really interesting, kind of the way he has to, he has all this energy to make something, but he has to apply it in a different manner and it has to come out in these different ways. And, I just found the film immensely pleasurable to watch, despite certain reservations that exist. And honestly, it made me sad that he's going to go do a fourth Transformers, which starts shooting in about a month or so. And I've never cared about what he does, really, ever. But seeing this, it made me realize that there are possibilities to Michael Bay's career that had kind of been unexploited before, or at least I don't think had been possible since the 90s, really. So I think that Pain and Gain is a very interesting, unique achievement of its own.
All right. Danny, what about yourself?
Well, I am similarly positive on Pain and Gain. I like saying the title. I'm not going to lie.
All right.
So going into this film, I was actually, Nick was assigned a review, and I was assigned to kind of write a piece on how factual the film is, and I'm still working on that, but I think it maybe affected my viewing experience a little bit, because throughout the film I was taking notes, and I usually take notes if I'm going to write about a film, but often it's not writing down facts to compare to newspaper articles, but that's what it was here. So I wonder if something about that, and also knowing the story beforehand and how dark the material gets, I wonder if that maybe took away from a certain wow factor that was there potentially. But nonetheless, I like the film, and I primarily like it because of the personality of Michael Bay. And I mean, just looking at recent films that have been number one at the box office, I mean, like The Croods, and like,
Jesus, was that number one?
Yeah, and
oh,
like,
my God.
G.I. Joe.
That was number, oh man, I only half remember those movies coming out, and
yeah,
I had to review,
like,
The Croods for the TV show I do.
And like, I mean, like Identity Thief.
What?
Yeah.
Man, I do not pay enough attention to the box office anymore.
But that, like, that was a huge hit.
Was it?
Yeah.
I thought it flopped. What is wrong with me? Am I having a stroke?
Well, Lord. Okay. The point is,
yes,
it's unique for a film that is so brash to make money like that and to be, yeah, I mean, if when you just compare it to the company, it stands out. And I think the cinema score is actually telling, because this is an offensive film in the sense that it is about Michael Bay's sensibility, which is often offensive. But at the same time, that's something to be applauded, because a lot of these films that are made with the intention of kind of dominating the box office are diluting things like that, so they appeal to everyone and they send the target audience home happy. Like 42 had an A+ cinema score. So I think there's something to be said for a film like this that is so just completely itself and completely okay with being offensive and telling terrible jokes and being racist and everything, which probably sounds weird, but that's one of the reasons I like it.
All right. Yeah. I loved this movie. Holy God. Yeah. I was up in the air going into it, 'cause I feel like I probably had the same reaction of a lot of people. Like, this looks batshit crazy amazing, but at the same time, like, it's Michael Bay, like, what if he's not in on his own joke? And there was a concern, because it really did feel like he was gonna do his, like, self-aware kind of masterpiece, and I think he totally pulled it off. And it's a little funny, because, like, at the beginning of this movie, I mean, it starts with the trailer, basically. We had been talking about this earlier, and it's just crazy that, like, they burst into this. It's Goodfellas, Like, that's all I could think. Because this crazy thing happens. They're in a moment of, like, violence and madness. And then you just get that, you know, that iconic opening line of narration. Where instead of, like, you know, for as long as I can remember I always wanted to be a gangster, it's, you know, my name's Daniel Lugo and I believe in fitness. It's just like, and just like, because every other character has their own voiceovers and everything is melding together, it was total Goodfellas from front to back. Mm. And it's not as good as Goodfellas, but it has that sense of purpose and knowledge about itself. And it's weird in that, you know, most Michael Bay films, you think like the ripped guy is going to win in the end. And this is all about, you know, just beating up the weaker people. And, you know, it's kind of that macho, just angry, like, you know, just there's that weird sensation of like the greater power will overcome through sheer force and get the like skanky kind of like half stripper looking girl. And in this, they take all of that and they just kind of completely throw it in a blender and mix it around with the kind of self-awareness that I was not expecting, even though I was hoping for it. And between that and the music and the performances and the dialogue and the visual humor, I was kind of on board for almost everything. There's still one or two things that are just a little bit too Michael Bay. He's got a very juvenile sense of humor sometimes.
He does.
But
stunningly so.
But I feel like that's like you can't take that away from him. So I was happy to see that it didn't overpower this movie to the point that it could have. And yeah, I don't know, man. I sat down in the chair and once this movie kicked off, I was just like, let's do this. And it was awesome. It was absolutely incredible.
So yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know like how to begin to like sort out my feelings towards this film. I feel like a lot of the praise has to go to the three main actors, because Mark Wahlberg is just, I mean, like, this guy, every once in a while I see him in something, like, I don't know, I didn't see Broken City, but I don't have to see Broken City to know probably what's gonna go on in it. And it's just like he could live in those roles, but then he takes things like this that are very like self-aware and self-assured, and he instills in this like dumb jackass meathead like this kind of weird heart where like for a while you kind of want him to succeed because he just has like this goofy brash sense of like self that just becomes perverted with the more seeming success that he gets. And then Dwayne Johnson, I mean, he's just that big lovable goofball guy. Mm-hmm. But again, he still invests his character with like this kind of weird energy that's like it fleshes it out to three dimensions. And then I just love Anthony Mackie and everything.
Yeah. I think Dwayne Johnson is sort of that character in the way it's written and the way it's performed kind of encapsulates the whole movie. Mm-hmm. Where there is something, I feel like a lot of people are going to look at this film and they're going to take it as more of the same from Bay, and therefore they're not going to like it, which I understand and I can sympathize with. But I think much like the film, the character that Dwayne Johnson is playing, it's, even though there are serious things about him, even though you can find things in there to sort of consider, he is not necessarily to be taken seriously in a certain sense of the word. Like, that much is evident, but I feel like it's sort of the key to the entire film in a lot of ways is that character and sort of how you're going to react to him. In a way that I wasn't expecting, and I think part of it comes from, this sort of speaks to the movie as a whole. I wasn't expecting it because I guess, even though I really like Dwayne Johnson, I haven't really thought of him as much like a great actor necessarily. But the performance he gives here is legitimately excellent. And yeah. It is, like Pain and Gain as a whole, it really truly surprised me. And, I don't know. I think that it might be the most valuable thing to be found in the entire movie. And to me, it is sort of, it sounds weird, it's Pain and Gain's Rosetta Stone, I guess.
Dwayne Johnson's performance in Pain and Gain is to Pain and Gain what the like creation of the universe scene is to the Tree of Life.
Sure.
Okay. No, I mean, I completely understand.
Well, actually, it's funny because Danny, when we left, we were walking on a... we were walking down 42nd Street and he tweeted, Pain and Gain is Michael Bay's The Tree of Life. Which got a good reaction.
It was a nonsense tweet, but like just fun. I think one person tweeted back at me like, I'm not sure if that's a good thing. And I was just like, yeah, don't worry about it. Like it's a joke.
So, it's like indulging the worst impulses.
Yeah.
Like, quote unquote, except in a way that's just like transcendent of everything.
Yeah.
I totally 100% agree about Dwayne Johnson's performance. This is how much I agree. I have begun calling him solely by his Christian name instead of inserting The Rock or just calling him The Rock. Something that I'm sure I will not be able to do for Fast 6.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, because in that, it's just like, that is The Rock. That is the guy who, can you smell what he's cooking? Like, this movie, like, I wasn't thinking about him like that. I was like,
in this movie, he's literally cooking.
Oh, God.
But you don't want to smell it.
Yeah. When we get into spoilers, I want to ask Danny about that. Since you might be able to help us hash out some of what's real and what's not. All
right.
And, I don't know. He brought a lot of heart to his character. And, like, you really kind of feel for him. And I don't understand how he does that, because he does some despicable things. And he's a very intimidating man. The other great thing about this movie is that it's not afraid to make these guys sympathetic by juxtaposing their actions as almost a kind of Robin Hood against a just thoroughly despicable character who is, like, everything that you'd expect, like, the put-upon, like, dumb shit villain of a Michael Bay film to be. Except for the fact that, like, the film is strangely pro-law and pro-morality, and this sense of, like, what's right is right, and it doesn't matter if, like, you feel innately that it's an okay thing to do, because it's still wrong. I mean, Ed Harris, who plays the private detective, even says of Victor Kershaw, played by Tony Shalhoub, like, you're a very hard victim to sympathize with.
Mm.
Something along those lines. And it's so true. And it's like, you know, I kind of don't give a shit that these guys stole all of his money. But, you know, that's just not okay. It's just the way that you're not supposed to be.
Well, the script has a very careful hand in building it up in a way that I would not at all ever expect from Michael Bay, honestly. Kind of how, you know, you see that the Tony Shalhoub character is quite a bad man. And by all accounts, the three characters here are actually not... At first, they really don't seem like bad guys. They might, you know, have troubled intentions, and they're, you know, not very smart, and they have certain problems. Certainly, they have flaws, but when they actually want to take his money, you kind of don't concern yourself that much. But then the way the movie kind of switches on a dime, and it goes to these scenes where they're torturing Tony Shalhoub's character, was hugely effective. Particularly, I think I think it sort of comes to a head. I mean, it does come to a head, but it kind of reaches a logical endpoint when first they try to kill him by driving the car into a wall, and then they try to set him on fire, and then they try to run him over. All three of which are really horrific, and all three of which fail terribly.
Right.
And it's funny, but it's also just hugely horrific to watch. You know, the way that they put a seatbelt in the car because Anthony Mackie figures he has to be safe.
Right.
Right.
Gosh.
Right. And then it's just in the way The Rock doesn't want to kill him, too.
They keep trying to force, like, the soul. Like, The Rock keeps trying to say, we killed him, and they keep trying to push it, like, purely on him.
Yes.
It's messed up.
Mm-hmm. It's
not great, guys.
Yeah, no, it is sort of the turning point of the movie. And then when you sort of get into the Michael Bay isms, sort of, it is interesting how that comes about once they do something wrong and as they spiral down into a hole. And I'm kind of surprised people aren't taking that transition more at face value. Or rather, I'm sorry, I should say, I'm surprised that they're taking it at face value and they're not sort of thinking about the way that it comes around. It's a very sort of deliberate method of delivery. How suddenly they have this huge shift, and it starts to feel more like a Michael Bay movie, but in the best and worst ways possible. So that's that.
I didn't want to be the first one to interject because I feel like I've been hogging it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Were there any? I mean, we've been pretty much almost resoundingly universal in our praise at the moment. Were there any aspects of this film that, before we get into spoilers to talk about a little bit of plot, anything that kind of rubbed us the wrong way? Anything we didn't like quite so much?
Well, we've mentioned the voiceover a couple times, mm-hmm. and you know, like you said, it's perfect at the beginning because once Mark Wahlberg just starts saying "I'm hot" to the camera, there is no doubt about where this film stands and how like aware it is. But it is surprising how prevalent the voiceover is throughout and how many characters it shifts to. You know, like my Tree of Life tweet was a joke, but the voiceover, you know, it's probably like 6 or 7 characters have a voiceover, and that's unusual for a film. So I know Nick and I were talking about this afterwards, and kind of trying to decide whether it works fully or not. And it definitely didn't actively bug me while I was watching the film, but it is something that I don't know if either of you two had a stronger opinion on, just because it is sort of an unexpected trait for the film to have.
I don't know. I didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah,
it was
funny. Like it's
it actually
funny.
Yeah, it's funny, and it's there's like this humor, and like there's this freneticism to everything, and this humor that's found not only in the voiceovers where Dwayne Johnson's character will be like, you know, Danny was a mastermind, and then Anthony Mackie's character will almost immediately shoot back in his own mind, completely independent of Dwayne Johnson's, like, you know, Danny was just winging all this, like none of this meant anything.
Yeah,
it sort of made me think of The Thin Red Line, kind of. This movie is sort of like The Thin Red Line.
Am I the only one who went to Goodfellas?
Yeah, I'm surprised I didn't think of that more.
Yeah,
I guess
when you said it made sense, yeah.
The big point of comparison has actually been Fargo, which I don't really...
There's no voiceover in Fargo.
No, but sort of the crime gone wrong, I guess, type of thing. One thing that I read on Twitter, which I think is perfect, someone said that Pain and Gain is Burn after reading as directed by Brad Pitt's character.
Yeah.
yeah, so there's that. But anyway, I would say that, yeah, I found the voiceover to be a bit much because there's just too much of it, and I feel like it kind of it doesn't have an entirely coherent center to it. There are moments where it comes in and it kind of feels like just an easy way for the movie to get across a certain point or character beat, when really I feel like it could have been more implicitly understood just in terms of what was happening on screen at that moment. And also, well, first it's like, why does the stripper person have a flashback slash voiceover for 1 minute? It's an example like that, which just felt unnecessary to me. But also, I did find that the editing of the movie is kind of problematic because it does, I said that it does move at a good pace, which I do stand by, but structurally it is kind of odd how there are these title cards kind of introducing what are supposed to be new segments, but they don't really, not new segments, but more like these new sections of the story, but they don't really feel like that to me. They'll kind of have a title card come up, and then the movie will continue playing for as long as 45 minutes before another enters, and a lot has transpired at that time, because the movie moves at a good pace. You know, it's clicking along, and then you kind of have this other title card, and you're only reminded that these are existing in the film when they actually show up, which, granted, is a testament to the way it's handled overall, but I do feel that perhaps it could have benefited from abandoning those altogether. Even then, I think that maybe maintaining the voiceover would have felt a little more coherent if the title cards weren't there, because that sort of reinforced the whole based on a true story angle and kind of, you know, the movie almost feels like at times like it's being narrated by people who are kind of being interviewed behind bars for some kind of magazine article or whatever, which is actually where the movie comes from.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea, but it doesn't really reach a good point. It doesn't have a...
Which again, I mean, like, exactly like Goodfellas.
I'm surprised that
everyone went to Malick. Goodfellas.
Well, no, I mean, that's only...
Casino?
The thing is, Goodfellas is only... First of all, it's only one person, and
no,
secondly...
Lorraine Bracco's got some voiceover in there.
Does she?
Yeah, she's got that one thing where she's like, you know, I know most women would have like run around.
Her boyfriend
hands him a gun.
But the thing is, even then, that actually, you know, Goodfellas handles that in a very interesting way, where it actually the movie kind of catches up to itself in the courtroom, and then Ray Liotta starts talking to the camera. It kind of has that. But Painting Game doesn't. There is sort of the Ed Harris part of it, but it kind of doesn't. I don't think it ties together fully. So.
All right. And we should get into spoilers so we can begin to try to start wrapping up. I actually liked some of the title cards and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Specifically one that I want to talk about with Danny, since he's our fact checker. Other than that, I mean, like, there's a shit scene and a midget scene, which are just Michael Bay being Michael Bay. Not entirely necessary, though. So...
Really? I think they're necessary.
I don't feel the need to see Dwayne Johnson choke a midget and like pull him up a wall, and I don't feel like I need to see an entire hospital bathroom covered in feces.
All right.
That's just me.
You've convinced me.
But let's do it. Let's get into spoilers now. Just to see about this, because we've talked about the construction, we've talked about the plotting and the characters. I think that the movie drags only a little bit towards the build up to the second robbery that the guys do, which I didn't even know was going to happen, so that caught me off guard. And Danny, I mean, I just have to know, did they actually try to barbecue the fingerprints off the hands?
Good question.
Do we not know this yet?
I don't remember that specifically, the fingerprints. They did, though, like, get the buckets and cut up the bodies. I would doubt that they grilled them, you know, outside on a sunny afternoon.
He was on a lot of cocaine.
He was. That's true. The interesting thing about the articles is that they're incredibly long.
Yeah.
So I read them once in full a couple months ago, and I've kind of been like working my way back through them. And so now I'm glad you brought that up, because I will go back and look for the fingerprint section and see if they did grill them or do that.
Okay, good. Because that's the point where the title card comes up and it says, this is still a true story.
Yeah, I mentioned this to Nick. I had a mini theory that title card wasn't just like a funny insert, but actually sort of when the movie went less and less away from the true story.
Okay.
Because like there's a moment in the climax where like Tony Shalhoub runs over Mark Wahlberg with a car or something. Yeah, and there's no way that happened. That's just like climax mechanics or whatever you want. But a lot of the crazy stuff before is true. Like Lugo convinced his wife or whatever that he was in the CIA. and she believed him.
Good Lord.
And they tried to kill him like five times, five different ways, and couldn't do it. So, yeah. I would say the last third is probably the least faithful.
All right. That's crazy.
Yeah.
It is absolutely bananas. Yeah, other than that, I don't really know if I have anything to say in spoilers, because I feel like half the fun of this movie is just like trying to keep up with the insanity, and we've already talked about a lot of the other stuff too. But didn't want to deprive people of the wonder that was Dwayne Johnson grilling some hands while making eyes at a security guard.
Yeah, it is remarkable.
Yeah, this movie is pretty fucking fantastic. I feel like we can all just agree on that. So, any final thoughts before we close this out?
Hopefully the Michael Bay's subsequent films are around 130 minutes and not 160.
That would also be nice. I'm on Nick's side with being upset that he's going back to the Transformers.
Yeah.
All right. That's it. Pain and Gain. Go check it out. It's in theaters everywhere, and it's quite worthy of your time. So let's get into the things that are going to be coming out, see if they are also worthy of your time. Hitting theaters next week, we have Iron Man 3. The newest Marvel film, starring Robert Downey Jr., Gwyneth Paltrow, Guy Pearce, Don Cheadle, and Ben Kingsley?
That's right.
Wow, I don't know why I just blanked on his name. Not doing too well today.
Also, love his voice in that trailer.
Yeah, he's well, it's weird because it seems like he's trying out two different voices. Am I the only one who's feeling that?
I don't know. I've only seen the trailer once, but I still remember being like, yeah, yeah.
Everyone's got their... Ever since Heath Ledger, everyone's had to like try to make up their own new crazy idiosyncratic voice.
Yeah.
And Ben seems to be doing a pretty good job. Mm. Not going to lie. I'm glad that Michael Shannon kind of just went with screaming Michael Shannon in The Man of Steel.
Sure.
This is directed by Shane Black, who did Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which also had Robert Downey Jr. Good film. I don't know about this one. Heard great things, but, you know, I've been burned before by Marvel. Love Is All You Need. Scatter My Ashes at Bergdorf's. The Iceman, speaking of Michael Shannon. Something in the Air. What Maisie Knew. And Kiss of the Damned. Thoughts, gentlemen.
I'm probably... The thing is, I have things going on, you know, for the next couple of weeks. So I'm probably not going to see Iron Man 3 until the school year ends, really. And I just have no qualms about that, I guess. I feel nothing about that. I'm kind of thinking, okay, yeah, I guess I'll just see it in a double feature with The Great Gatsby or something. Just go from one to the other. Don't worry, I'll pay to see Gatsby. That's what I'll support. You need not worry. You know, I mean, I like the first Iron Man still. The second one, not so much. The Avengers was, you know, relatively fun, if sort of more like a decent way to pass the time with a movie, I guess, than something I really kind of got a lot out of. And I feel like, you know, sort of... See, to me, the best Marvel movie is probably Thor, honestly, because that's a movie
Captain
which...
Captain America.
Because to me, Thor very strongly understands sort of that balance between the fact that people really do enjoy this, and it has like a reverence for that, sort of the enjoyment that people get out of a film like this, but it also is not afraid at all to look at it and understand how ridiculous it really is. Granted, I mean, Thor, I don't think it's a great film. It has a number of issues, a number of very clear issues, but I do think what it does very well. And I think that Shane Black, being a sort of a action comedy voice, maybe in some ways the action comedy voice, because he made, you know, Lethal Weapon and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, hopefully can imbue some of his skills into this. Early reviews indicate that's the case, but movies like this, I'm generally kind of wary of the first wave of reactions, because a movie like The Avengers was getting very positive notices right before its release, and then I saw it and I thought, well, okay, I mean, the movie's fine, but I don't really need to, you know, I don't really understand what exactly about this movie deserves more than a B, say.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what's weird about a movie like Iron Man 3 is that I feel like I'm going to be plenty satisfied if this movie is just a B-quality film. But I don't really like to have that sense of complacency in cinema, I guess. I'd prefer it be, like, you know, really bad or really good than just sort of
okay.
Just sort of fine. You know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, the thing about Thor is that when I saw that, I actually really enjoyed myself.
Yeah.
I felt like there was real entertainment value in it. And I don't know if, outside of the first Iron Man, I don't think any of the other Marvel movies have really achieved that.
You didn't feel that way about Captain America?
Captain America, I thought was okay. I wasn't a huge fan of it.
Oh, man, I loved that movie.
Yeah, no, I wanted to love it. I did. But
I could probably sing that song right now.
Yeah. I mean, no, scenes like that I enjoyed, because that it sort of has that, again, that sort of that quality to it where it's understanding of sort of what makes these movies work, and in a weird way, why these movies kind of can't work in any other context. Mm-hmm. But the rest of Captain America felt sort of familiar and kind of a little rote to me, honestly. And that's how I feel about most of the series.
Yeah, unfortunately, the same for me. Danny, what about yourself? Thoughts?
In terms of the Marvel movies?
I mean, in terms of anything coming out this weekend.
Well, and The Iceman is a movie about a killer played by Michael Shannon. So that will be seen by me.
Oh, wait. Okay, here's a question that's with the zeitgeist. Have you all seen Michael Shannon reading the sorority girl letter?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fantastic. I am so proud to be an alum of the University of Maryland.
Is that where the letter's from?
That's where she's from.
Oh.
And okay. I partied with some DG girls before, and yeah, that makes sense. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, just well done, Michael. You're on a roll.
Okay, so coming to DVD, Silver Linings Playbook, a lot of Star Trek, Broken City, speaking of Mark Wahlberg, Guilt Trip, Strictly Ballroom, Not Fade Away, the film by David Chase, mm-hmm. and yeah, I don't know, that's all I can see. If anyone else wants to highlight something...
Not Fade Away, one of my favorite movies of 2012. I think that is a really fantastic movie. Unfortunately, kind of got buried upon its release because for some reason, I don't know, I guess, who released that? I guess it was Paramount Vantage, thought that it could be an awards contender, which is weird because the movie is, it's a very small and a very strange movie. It's not at all something that would sort of get that attention. And I do think that now that it's on home video, hopefully people can discover it and kind of get a better idea of what the movie is going for, because it is strangely esoteric, I think. But not that anything has been, you know, normally esoteric, I suppose, by the very definition of the word.
Pretty average esoteric.
Yeah, exactly. Terrible cover art.
Yeah,
really, really bad cover art.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, there are no bridges in the entire movie. So I don't know why there's an image of a bridge on the cover.
It's symbolic or something. You brought up this cover before. This has really stuck with you.
Yeah, I guess maybe I have. But yeah, Not Fade Away. I advise people to seek it out.
Okay. I'll throw my hat into the ring of the Silver Linings Playbook.
The Silver Linings Playbook?
God damn with the definite articles. Silver Linings Playbook. I don't remember how negative I came off on that film, but in retrospect, it's not that bad. I still feel like it lets its own characters down a little bit, but still an enjoyable film, and probably the best thing coming out this week that I've seen. Danny, thoughts?
Well, speaking of great cover art, that Broken City cover is just stunning.
So generic.
Yep.
I mean, like, you can tell that city is
not
put together, and it is broken. But I actually did see Broken City.
Yeah, you talked about some sort of scene with Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, there's an amazing sequence of an indie film premiere where Mark Wahlberg sees his spouse in, like, a softcore sex scene and subsequently starts drinking when we've been told that he's been sober for 7 years.
Jesus.
And it is one of the greatest sequences I have seen this year. Just for purely humorous reasons. And I don't know if it's worth the price of a Blu-ray, but consider it if you have some money. That
maybe Redbox it.
Yeah, Redbox is a better choice.
All right. So yeah, that leaves us with just our random recommendations. So Danny, what do you think is something that you've seen that other people should check out?
Well, the experience I have to mention was Saturday night. I saw a 35mm print of Andrei Rublev, which I think a lot of people consider one of the best films that has been crafted in the world.
Exact and, wording too.
And the, I mean, like, I'm kind of struggling with it because I'd like to be able to say more about the movie, but it's just like so dense, and it was one of those things where while I was watching scenes, I was aware of the fact that, like, I was probably not picking up on like 80% of what was going on in the movie, and I don't even think that's like a bad thing. I feel like after a while, I kind of admitted to myself that, like, this is not a movie that I will process fully on one viewing. And, yeah, so I don't have a lot of, like, comprehensive things to say about it, but it is, you know, a great achievement. A new film called At Any Price. Dennis Quaid, Zac Efron. And it fits with what we've been talking about, because it is very much a film about American values. But I would make the argument that it's probably the darkest one we've seen so far this year, because it has this really troubling mixture of like sincerity, but also self-criticism. The opening scene of the film, like, you can tell right away, like, Dennis Quaid is just off his rocker in this movie. And so, like, in some contexts, it would be judged as like an over the top performance or like something that's just weirdly hammy, but it kind of works within the film's tone, which is like, it's not necessarily anti-American or anti-America, but it is very critical of like the values that his character represents. And I mean, the result, in my opinion, is like an incredibly disturbing and dark film that's probably worth seeing. And yeah, I think it's been going under the radar a bit. I would encourage you to see it.
All right. Excellent. And Nick, what about yourself?
I'm going to go with Le Cercle Rouge, also known as The Red Circle, which is a 1970 movie from Jean-Pierre Melville, starring Alain Delon. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You're usually our...
Alain Delon. I'm not entirely sure. Sorry. You've probably all heard of this movie. Maybe some have seen it. It's a crime film that was sort of best known for, I think, like most of Melville's movies, it kind of has this very austere, controlled, sort of sterile style to it that the movie kind of almost reminds me of what it made me think of was a movie almost like by Walter Hill, kind of the way it's, very, it's cut down to the bone. Even literally the cutting of the film feels very bare and to the point, which is interesting because the movie is 140 minutes long, but in that time it tells this crime story, which is actually, I think, relatively simple. There isn't, in terms of like plotting, there isn't actually that much to digest. But the movie has a really kind of fascinating look at sort of morality and criminal code and ethics and the relationship between between criminals and the police. And it features this amazing performance from Mr. Delon, let's just put it that way, who he had worked with, Melville had worked with in Les Samurai, which is possibly his best-known film. Unfortunately, it was the only Melville picture I'd seen up until this one. But watching it made me want to check out his other, you know, his other work, other pieces of work that he's done. Other pieces of work that he's done. Wow. Yeah, I found the movie really... really sort of kind of intoxicating, I guess, is the word I'd use. Very kind of hypnotic in a strange way. So go go watch it tonight or something. Just watch it soon.
Okay. My movie is going to be... I hate that I don't have time to go out and see these culturally important films that you all get to talk about. Because I'm going to be talking about Varsity Blues.
Oh my god.
I may be coming at this movie from the viewpoint of someone who first saw this film when it came out, 1999. Surprisingly, I think that was either not long before or after I saw The Thin Red Line. I was
very close.
I was about to say, I was 12 or 13 at the time. And this movie is probably only stuck in my head because of a few very key scenes.
Does one of them involve hitting a can of beer off of someone's head?
That is one of them, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
The other one involves a swimsuit that is not made out of fabric.
Oh, God. It's a terrible movie.
It's not a good movie, but it's a fun movie to watch.
Yes.
I mean, it's what it, like, okay, so this is how it goes down. Like, I'm watching this movie, and a friend walks into the room, and it's just like, oh my god, is this Varsity Blues? It's like, yeah. It's like, oh, did the scene with the bikini come on yet? It's like, no, I don't think so. And then, like, they just sit and wait for it. And then, like, if they get bored, they leave. But when they, right before they leave, everyone always has to say, I don't want your life.
very funny to me because I haven't seen it. I get all the references.
Well, that's the problem, Danny. You got to see it. Because to people who came up and were of age when this movie came out, it's a very specific kind of film that I don't know how to explain it. But there are moments and references and things about it that will be remembered forever in our small minds. So I'm just going to say, if you haven't seen it, check it out. If you have seen it, remember how much fun you had watching it, and then get drunk and watch it again. And then go see Andrei Rublev.
Great double feature.
Absolutely. I feel like this is the modern day version of that story.
I haven't read that interpretation yet, but I agree.
Okay, excellent. I'm glad to see we're on the same page. That is it then. Thank you all for sticking with us. I know that this episode has gone a little longer than usual, but we had a lot to talk about, and we hope you've enjoyed it. So, let us tell you where you can find more of our stuff to enjoy in the meantime. Danny, where can you be found online?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman and thefilmstage.com.
And I can be found on twitter.com/BrianJRowan, thefilmstage.com, and my personal blog, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Join us next week when we'll be talking about Iron Man 3 and Something in the Air. Let us know if you have any of the...
And he's kind of held back a bit.
There's a plane.
Is there? Okay, sorry.
I don't know. Where the fuck do you live?
My school is directly next to an airport.
Okay.